Good stuff. Welcome to the podcast, Louise Cheeseman.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
No, good to have you on. So you're well known in the Hull local area, but for listeners, watchers outside of Hull, do you want to just give us a bit of what you've been up to for the last sort of 5 or 6 years?
Okay, so people locally probably know me best for being managing director of Hull Trains during some pretty dark times. Both when we had some real challenges with the fleet we were running before our new Paragon fleet entered service. And obviously the pandemic was pretty horrendous for the business as well. Once the business was back on its feet, I was offered the opportunity to lead London Buses, which I couldn't turn down. So I've been in London for the past 3 years leading London Buses. And in January, decided to take a back seat. I would say, people say, have you retired? I haven't actually retired fully, but I'm certainly stepping back a little bit and doing a few less hours than I have been doing over the past few years.
And what are you doing? You talked about the minibus and coach. Do you want to just give us a bit of an overview of what that is, what that looks like?
Yeah, so during my time in London, I inherited a huge problem with bus driver shortages. And when I started to do some research into why we had such huge shortages, 2,000 bus drivers were short of. If you put it in context, there's 26,000 bus drivers in London. So 2,000 is about 8 or 9%, but it's still significant. And started to crunch some numbers and look at the data. And what became really clear that only 9% of the people that work in the bus and coach industry in London are women. And when I started to talk to other operators and other public authorities across the UK, the same problem was in their areas too. I've got contacts across Australia and they're saying exactly the same thing. And when I then started to look at things like the driver's cab, which is their office, or the uniforms, or the rosters, none of them really have had a lot of thought into how we could encourage women into the industry. It's an amazing industry, one which you can come in at entry level as a bus driver and you can go right up to managing director if you wanted to, or equally you can go in as a head of or a manager. But it's not very well documented what great opportunities there are. So I was part of Women in Rail, which was a huge success, and you'll see that if you're ever out and about on trains. When I left Hull Trains as managing director, 55% of the train drivers were women, which was absolutely unheard of.
Brilliant.
So why can't you do the same with the bus and coach industry? There's a huge pool of talent out there. And so I launched Women in Bus and Coach, and we launched that in June of last year, and since then it's been just incredible the interest we've had, and a lot of bus operators, coach operators, bus manufacturers, uniform manufacturers all want to be part of it, and we're hoping that that'll make a significant difference. Obviously for me it's voluntary, I'm doing it in my own time, but I've got a real passion for it. I joined the rail industry in 2001 and was one of very few female railway guards in Hull. The uniform wasn't great for a woman, the toilet facilities weren't great, and it really wasn't geared up for women. But I joined as a guard, having no qualifications, in 2001, and ended up becoming a managing director of a rail operating company. So if I can do it, anybody can. And you know, I just see so much talent there that's not being tapped into. So if we can make a difference, that would be fantastic. So that's what I'm putting a lot of time and effort into at the minute.
Brilliant.
You'd think, you know, we go to the bus side of your career. You'd think the fact that there is such a shortage, why? And you mentioned that when you created, you know, Women in Bus and Coach, why? And then suddenly uniform manufacturers are interested in having a cop. Why none of these actually, before you know, sort of broke the ice, came up and said, why aren't you doing more, you know, why aren't you getting more females involved and things like that? It just seems staggering that it's been really narrow-minded sort of thought process.
Well, I think the bus manufacturers is probably the best example, because, you know, when Sir Transport for London has around about 8,500 buses. So they have a really very close relationship with bus manufacturers. So part of my job would be to go to Ballymena to see Wright Bus, who are manufacturers, or ADL at Scarborough, to talk to them about what we wanted in buses in London, because we tended to lead the way because we were such a big we approached a lot of bus companies, and we, the operators bought a lot of the buses, but we set the specification. When I asked them about how they worked their design for the bus cabs, which is the office, if you think about it, for a bus driver, and we talked about how they designed it, and I talked about women, they looked surprised that I would even be talking about ergonomic assessments using women as an example. And it's just changing that mindset. Toilets, I mean, if you look in London, it's a pretty disgusting subject, but if you look at a normal bus station in London, that toilet that has 800 bus drivers going through that station every day, 800, there's one toilet. So if you're a woman or a man using those sort of facilities. Now, I always default to, I've got two daughters. Would I want them in the industry for those reasons? Probably not at the minute. So we have to change that. We have to make it a really attractive and exciting career for women and men. And I do think that if we can get it right, the men will benefit as well. Mm. You know, we will create a diverse workforce where things like cabs, uniforms, toilets, rosters will work for everybody and not just women.
And are you getting any traction in that in terms of the percentage that are women working in the industry in London?
We are starting to see it come through. We're seeing a huge interest from women. What's happening as well is through social media, LinkedIn, women are now starting to come forward and speak up about some of the challenges they have. So we are going around a lot of depots, not just in London, but in Scotland. We're going to Wales to talk to the staff to say, you know, what are some of the issues that you're experiencing? What can we help with? And what can we be a conduit between you and your bus operator, whoever that might be, to really start having those conversations? Because it might cost the operator a little bit of money, but boy, the return would be enormous because women tend to stay. They are quite loyal, and they offer fantastic customer service as well. They're very empathetic. They are 51% of our passengers on buses are women. Yep. So if you've got a woman bus driver meeting you with a smiling face, it's a really great customer experience. So everybody's a winner. So yeah, it's been a huge success. So, you know, we're really putting a lot of effort into that.
Good. I was reading about your career, and you kind of touched on it a second ago in terms of, and you said within your industry, it's possible to start at the bottom and work your way right up to the top. And you did, right, becoming an MD at Hull Trains. So if there's a couple of things that kind of helped you achieve that, what do you think were the keys to you going right from the bottom of the industry right to the kind of top of the industry?
I never set out to become a managing director. I joined the rail industry as a guard because my two daughters, I went to their open night at school, and the teacher said to me, "You've got two very bright daughters, you know, they can go to university. We need to start thinking about AirCast forms." I'd never heard of any of this sort of, I'd left school at 16 with a handful of pathetic qualifications, one of them being cookery, and I live on ready meals, so that sort of says everything. But I went to the open night, and I was a single mum, and they said, you know, they could do really well, we ought to go to university. And I was horrified because I had very little income. And when I started to research universities and saw how much it cost, I was horrified. So I went out and got the Hull Daily Mail, as it was then, and opened the page on a Wednesday night and looked at the jobs. And there was a half page advert for train guards. And I've never been on a train. It's not something that interests me at all. And I just saw how much they got paid, and I thought, wow, you know, I would have washed floors. I would have done anything to make sure the girls had the same opportunities as everybody else. So I applied, and I was the only woman that got through to the selection process. There were 25 of us, and 24 of them were men, and I was the only woman. And each time you had an assessment for maths, for English, whatever it was, if you didn't reach the standard, you went home. So by the end of the day, there were four of us left, three men and myself, and I got called in for an interview. And the guy said, "Got some good news and got some bad news. The good news is you come top." Well, I never come top in anything in my life. But he said, "The bad news is I'm not going to put you through because I wouldn't want a daughter of mine working on the railway. And the mess room environment isn't great." And so we spent 20 minutes debating the rights and wrongs of this decision. And in the end, he went, "Oh, for goodness sake," because I'm very dogmatic when I get a bit between my teeth. oh, for goodness sake, I'll give you 3 months. Go away and do it, but you'll only last 3 months. And I'm here now. And that really sort of set the tone for who I am. I'm really dogmatic. I'm really resilient. I had 7 years as a garden, absolutely loved every minute of it. It's a great environment to work in. You see people the most bizarre times of the day at night, you know, midnight or 3 o'clock in the morning. So you see the best and the worst of people. But I had a couple of people in the industry who saw something in me. One person in particular who, when I got an opportunity to go and work at the Docklands Light Railway for the Olympic Games, I said, I'm not going to London. I've never been to London. It's not something, he said, I'm not really asking you, we're telling you. and my director at the time said to me, if you don't go, I'm going to put you in the car and drive you there myself. And they were the best words of advice I've ever had. Because me going to work in London and being part of the Docklands Light Railway delivery of the Olympics just catapulted me in terms of my career, because the Docklands Light Railway serviced all the major Olympic venues. So, you know, the Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth Park, Greenwich, all the major sites that were holding Olympic events were serviced by the DLR. So you couldn't afford to fail. Mm. It was the main focus for transport in the Olympics. So if it failed, it would have been huge.
No pressure.
And then at the end of the Paralympics, it was full of consultants, and you can imagine how many people working on it. The day after the last day of the Paralympics, I went into the offices and I was the only person left out of all the consultants, and they tripled the workforce to deliver it. And they asked me if I'd stay and stay there full time. If you'd asked me that 3 months before, I would have said absolutely no way, but I absolutely loved it. I loved being exposed to London and what that offered. Mm-hmm. And I agreed to stay, and I stayed there for 4 years, and probably the happiest 4 years of my life. So each time my career, it was different, a different transport mode. So I've worked at the Docklands Light Railway. I was a director for Manchester Metrolink, the biggest tram operator in the UK. Obviously then came back to work at Hull Trains, and then worked in buses. So I think the reason I've been successful is I'm hugely resilient. I hate failure. Failure isn't part of my DNA. But equally, as a leader, I absolutely love to see other people succeeding, and I get a real buzz out of that. And as a leader, being able to bring people up and see them shine, when somebody saw that in me, if I hadn't had the guy say to me, I'm going to put you in the car and drive you there myself, I probably still would be in that role in Newcastle where I was working at the time. So I think that, you know, I've had some amazing opportunities. You could say I might have been lucky, I've been in the right place at the right time, but I can't speak highly enough for the industry. And anybody listening, if you don't know what to do, have a look at the transport sector. It's got so many opportunities and it gives you such variety.
I'm intrigued, Louise. So you said earlier on, you know, a handful of, you know, qualifications, cooking, etc. What was the, I don't know, the light bulb moment that went from, you know, because at that point, you don't like to lose, and you like to be successful, encouraged, mm-hmm. etc. What was the light switch moment where you went, actually, I'm ambitious and I want to, you know, use nothing wrong with being a conductor on the rail, in the rail sector, but you went from conductor to MD when the driver of being a conductor was money to get your daughters yeah. to go to university, yeah. and then suddenly you're now running, you know, large institutions that we general public rely on.
Yeah, so that's a really easy question to answer. So I was part of the guards where you had training in customer service and you got presented with a certificate, and it was really great. But there was a lady presenting the certificates. It was in this event in Hull. She'd come over, she was a director for Northern, and I was leaving the venue and she called my name out and she said, have you got a minute, Louise? And it was like the king speaking. You know, I was hugely in awe of this woman, because she was one of the very, very few female leaders in transport. Her name was Diane Crowther. She pulled me to one side and she said, I've heard some really good things about you. Don't give up. you go as far as you can go. The only person stopping you is you. And she was probably the first person that's ever demonstrated belief in me. And because she was almost a role model in that, she was a very first, probably one of the very first really successful women leaders in transport. For her to actually recognise me in what was, you know, a role of a guard, it was very important that guards can't manage the railway without them. But, you know, she was a director or an MD at the time. For her to know me and know my name and say that, just I thought, wow, I lacked confidence. I always have lacked confidence. But for her to see something in me, it really sparked something in me. And I've watched her career over the years, and she knows now. We obviously, we've seen each other quite a bit through various different events we've both been at since. But she's been my my hero, if you like, and the person that I've always watched and aspired to be like. And watching her career develop and my career develop really gave me that momentum to think, yes, if she can do it, I can. So, yeah, that was great.
Yeah, really inspirational story. Can I ask you about Hull Trains? Because you touched on it earlier that there was some dark days, I'm sure, during COVID. So can you just talk to us about your time there and the challenges that you faced? And
So being managing director of Hull Trains was the hardest job I've ever had by a country mile, but the most rewarding. So it's quite ironic, really, because I remember standing on the platform when I was a guard at Northern. So Northern Trains run the stopper services to Scarborough or Sheffield. Rattly-rolly trains can be very cold in the winter, very hot in the summer, not very comfortable. So I used to stand on the platform and I used to watch Hull Trains. They hadn't been running that long at the time, but the girls used to wear long wool coats with big brimmed hats and the men used to wear suits. And they really were based on the airline industry. And I used to look across at these trains going to London and thinking, wow, you know, they're proper trains. Never thinking in a million years that one day I'd be managing director. But when I took over Hull Trains, I don't know if you remember The Beast from the East. So that was my first day as managing director of Hull Trains. Absolutely. We talk about a testimony of fire. And we'd got some rolling stock, some trains, which were very old, very difficult to maintain, were breaking down all the time. They were overheating, you know, you name it. My phone, 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the morning, used to be forever ringing saying we can't deliver the train service today because these trains can't be fixed and blah, blah, blah. We invested in 5 brand new state-of-the-art Hitachi trains, and boy, did we need them. Once those arrived, the Paragon fleet, as they're known as, they really did turn the business around. And I always knew it could be a successful business, and I always knew that it could be a very profitable business. Hull Trains is what's called an open access operator. Now, the difference between an open access operator like Hull Trains and a service like LNER, for example, is that Hull Trains lives or dies by its revenue. So if you don't sell train tickets, it doesn't make any money. So it's a standalone private business. So there's a lot of pressure on you as a leader of the business to make money. If you don't make money, you go out of business. So getting these new trains was absolutely critical. But what it did do, it gave us an opportunity to reinvent Hull Trains. And I'm hugely proud of Hull. I'm hugely proud of my roots. And I don't think it gets enough visibility or recognition. So we were determined to make this an ambassadorial tool for Hull. So if you go to King's Cross and you see Hull Trains standing there, you know it's from Hull because it's got photographs on the side of the train. You get on board and the train crew all speak with a Hull accent. We made sure we employed a company to make sandwiches in Hull. We employed a Hull cleaning company. We had the Hull Daily Mail at the time, Hull gin, Hull chocolate. So it was a real ambassadorial tool linking Hull to the capital. And that was really important. And in terms of corporate social responsibility, we started to support Spring Street Theatre, Gay Pride Week, schools, so that people could really see that Hull Trains wasn't just a metal box that moved people between the capital and Hull. Actually, we were an employer. We supported supply chain. So people would use us. They'd show loyalty towards us. when I took over Hull Trains, the insults and the abuse I got from social media because I was a managing director was awful. And quite rightly so. People were booking train tickets and the trains weren't turning up, or they were breaking down, or the people were getting stuck at Peterborough at midnight. I'm the leader of the business. I have to take responsibility for that. They didn't need to know the reasons why, because they were very complex. There were some very good reasons why it was happening, but that's not their problem. So when we finally got the new trains, we put new uniform on the staff. It was probably the proudest moment in my career was the first train to leave Hull Paragon Station, the new Hitachi bimodal trains. It meant so much to everybody in the business, and the business is really a real family business. Aunts, uncles, husbands, wives, friends, they all work there, and there's a real feeling of community, and everybody wanted to see that business succeed. So we'd gone from having these trains that were failing badly and letting our customers down to these beautiful state-of-the-art trains where the staff pick the colour of the train, they pick the internal seat covers, you know, they designed the name, the Paragon Fleet. We had a competition, and the winner picked Paragon Fleet name. So here we were. We had come out of this awful time where the trains were breaking down, brand new trains. Everybody's coming back. We were carrying more people than in the history of the business had ever carried. And it was just amazing. And then within 3 weeks, we were carrying fresh air. And because of the business, because we were an open access operator, if you don't sell tickets, you're not in business. And so you'd gone from this huge high to having to tell the staff of the business that we were going to hibernate the business and pull the trains off. And because we just had, it was damage limitation. Mm. How could we reduce the amount of money we were going to be losing? And we were losing because the trains were expensive to lease and we still wanted to pay the wages. And so for many, many weeks, my days were spent ringing MPs, ringing influencers, ringing anyone that could help us to fund us, because the other train operators all got support, financial support from the government, and we didn't, because we weren't a government business. We were a standalone business, a bit like the airlines.
Who owns Hull Trains? Is it
private? It's First Group. First Group, but okay. we run as a private business.
Yeah.
So I had Chris Heaton Harris and Grant Shapps on speed dial. They must have seen my name come up. Oh my God, it's her again. They said all the right things, you know, they were sorry and that, but I didn't want to lose Hull Trains because I knew what impact it would have on the city.
Mm.
You know, I knew that Hull Trains was so important to the economic success of Hull, and it just wasn't going to happen on my watch. But we had to make people redundant, which was so sad, but, you know, massive credit to the team. You know, they could have kicked up a stink. They didn't. They understood. And that's why for many months now, you'll have been on the trains and there hasn't been a trolley service in standard class. That's my fault. Blame me. It's come back now, thank goodness. The trolley's back on and the business is doing so well. But it was a massive balancing act between how could we keep as many people as we could, hibernate the trains for the period of time we needed to, and then gradually bring them back one service at a time. So we thought we were coming out of it, and blow me, did we then have to hibernate again because the second wave came. But, you know, it's back. Please use Hull Trains. Their performance figures now are the best in the industry. The customer experience is some of the best in the industry. And they're an absolute credit to the city. And, you know, if you ever want to support Hull, use Hull Trains, because they are doing so much for this city and they're such a flagship for what you can do. And it's quite interesting because you probably aren't aware, but there's a huge rail reform bill going through at the minute. And ironically, they're really pursuing open access as being like they're almost like the flagship of what good looks like in the rail industry.
Make it competitive.
Because you know, you've got great performance, you've got great customer experience, you go on to Hull Trains, and I think you'll all agree, you know, the team that work there are so passionate about their job. They absolutely love working for the business. You know, it's a family affair. You know, we were all from Hull. We all wanted Hull Trains to succeed. And, you know, I saw my team actually crying when Hitachi brought those trains in for the first time to let them see what we were getting, because they knew what difference that would make to them, to their jobs, to the stability of their families. It was absolutely fantastic.
Hi guys, just jumping in, I want to talk about one of the services we offer, which is robotic process automation, also known as RPA. That is software that replicates human behavior. So if you've got people downloading spreadsheets, attaching them to emails, going on portals, downloading information, moving data around, all that stuff is perfect for a robot. So if that's interesting, get in touch. Let's have a chat. Let's see if we can help. Enough from me. Back to the conversation.
I was going to ask Louise, so a couple of times I've wanted to ask this. So obviously your MD, you've decided we need to bring in new rolling stock to enhance reliability, experience, whatever. What was the time span from, so you're fighting fires on a daily, weekly basis with failing rolling stock. What was the time span from you signing on the dotted line to getting, you know, the new rolling stock to take you into the new age?
It was about 2.5 years.
That must have been the longest 2.5 years of your life.
Supply chain. Yeah, and because we knew that these trains were coming, and somehow it was trying to keep the old trains running and keep a customer base, because, you know, even politicians were getting grumpy with us, because as far as they were concerned, it was almost bringing shame to the city, because you've got Hull Trains written on the side of your train and they were failing, they were breaking down. But it was fantastic. I got the opportunity to go out to Italy where they were manufactured. I followed the manufacturer of them throughout the whole process. We included people like the trade unions in looking at designing the cab design so that it was how they wanted it to work. So, as I say, it was getting everybody involved, and there was a real passion there and an excitement that just grew and grew until they actually arrived that day.
Just to dig into, you mentioned you're resilient earlier, and clearly
sounds
you are.
Like it.
Yeah, but what's, and in business, there's lots of people under lots of stress, that, and you have to be resilient. What's your key? What's your trick? How do you handle it? Any silver bullets?
I do a lot of exercise, so I run 5 miles every day or most days. But I think what spurs me on is the people that work in the business. Success for me is seeing them have a job, develop their career, and that's why I don't want to fail. I almost have a fear of failure, because it's not my failure, it's the impact it has on the people that work in the business. And I've seen some great success stories over the years, of particularly in women who have little confidence or they have imposter syndrome, and just having those conversations with them and seeing them succeed. So I don't want to be seen to fail, because it would send the wrong message to other women in our industry. And it is tricky sometimes being the only woman in a male-dominated industry. I've been to conferences where I've gone as a director or a managing director, and the majority of the people in the conference have been men, and I've been asked to whiten your sugar, please. Mm. Or if you're in a meeting, I'm the only woman and I have to take the minutes. Mm. Well, no, I don't actually now. But that's the sort of environment that it's not nearly as bad now. It's a lot better than it was. But that's the sort of... So for me, I wasn't going to fail, because I was going to show everybody. And I didn't do very well at school, my own laziness probably, but there was a lot of people who probably knew me from school, and I didn't go to university or anything like that. I left at 16. So I think there was a lot about me proving to myself, but equally proving to other people that probably didn't have a lot of faith in me, that I would do this. And and because Hull is a local company, and obviously I'm, you can tell from my accent, I'm from Hull, I really wanted Hull Trains particularly to be a success.
You mentioned, Louise, about your own laziness at school. But if you look back, apart from self-analysis of a little bit lazy, but was there something, or was there that within the schooling system that just didn't engage with you that actually now has changed, or you, when you run businesses, say, actually, we need to make sure we do this or that?
Yeah, because I think, you know, we've all got talents, and our talents manifest themselves in different ways. I was hugely sporty. I absolutely loved playing football. But I went to a convent school and got told off for playing keepy-uppy with a netball, you know. And so they didn't really get me. And you know, somebody who's got a talent, whatever that talent may be, you know, we should promote it. And it's quite interesting because, as I said to you before we started recording, both my daughters have gone into education, and they're both all about, you know, let's encourage everybody, not just the high achievers, but everyone's got a talent, everyone's got a skill, let's find it and let's promote it. And because I wasn't in the top 10 of this, you know, my year, or it felt like there wasn't an interest there in me. And I don't like sitting down and writing documents. I'm fine critiquing and whatever. I'm much more a doer. I like to do things. I like to design things. I like to come up with great ideas and then let somebody go away and work them through. That's equally as important in a business as having someone that can write a 10-page document or a board report or create a spreadsheet. So everybody has a use and a value in a business, and it's just finding those attributes in everybody.
I can't have the MD of, or ex-MD of a train company on, not ask about HS2.
Yes.
I was doing some research earlier, just Googling how much the cost estimates are for it currently, and I couldn't get a number because it just changes every single week.
Yes.
But I think we spent $25 billion on it so far. So what's your view on that then? Is it the right thing to do? Is the scope right? Where has this gone wrong, if it has gone wrong?
Well, it's quite interesting because as director of buses at TfL, I was involved in the Euston station upgrade, which was getting ready for HS2 to come into Euston, which has now all been stopped, halted. It depends which side of the lens I'm talking through. If I was talking in my London lens, I think the connection between London and Birmingham, if ever you've tried to get to Birmingham from London, it's difficult. If we want to take lorries off the road, we want to reduce the number of cars on the road, we have to improve our infrastructure, rail included. So I see the value in that, particularly the freight element of things. We've got to reduce the number of lorries on the road. The railway at the minute is way over capacity. We can't cope with any more trains. So I see the value in that. In this area, locally, if you talk about between here and Leeds and Manchester, I think we've got a lot of things we need to get right before HS2 were to come. And if by stopping HS2 between Birmingham, Manchester and Leeds, if, as the government says they're going to give us that money for us to spend on other things, that is fantastic, because I've always said in business, let's get the basics right first.
Mm.
And if you look at things like bus services and rail services, there's an awful lot of work to do to get those basics right. You know, even getting a train from here to Leeds or here to Manchester, or if you want to go to Manchester Airport, Liverpool Airport.
Mm.
There are so many routes that need upgrading. So HS2 is great, but for me, that's a cherry on the cake. Right now, we need to get those basics right. And, you know, the Prime Minister came here the other week to Goole and had his meeting there, and was saying that, you know, he was committing to electrification between Hull and Leeds, I think it is. We've not seen any sign of that yet. If they actually put their money where their mouth is and start to invest more in transport, not just rail, but transport in this area, then the fact that they're not going to go ahead with it would be a silver lining to a cloud for us around here. I am passionate about this area, about making this area somewhere where people want to come, bring their businesses, run businesses. You know, property is cheaper, land is available. Come and run your business from Hull. And if we can get those connections right, it just makes it even better. And we have so much skill to offer here. So as I say, if they do what they say they're going to do and use the money that they were going to invest in HS2 for the second phase and they bring it to here, then I'd be happy to see it not go ahead, but get those basics right in the local area.
I was going to say, you've mentioned a few ifs there, Louise.
Yes.
Over your career, you know, in senior roles, and certainly with TfL and with running whole trains, you've had to deal with, you know, government quite a lot. You yes. said obviously during COVID you were constantly on the phone lobbying and things like that. How often do you feel they come through with what they say?
It's a loaded question.
It is a bit loaded. I did think that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, I was disappointed with the response during COVID. But I can't thank enough the local MPs cross-party. When COVID happened, you know, Emma Hardy and David Davis and Graeme Stewart and all, you know, they all supported me and asked, what do we need to do? You know, how can we help? So I think my answer to your question is probably not the answer you want, but if we can back our politicians, and I don't really care, I'm not political at all. I just want the best for this city and this area, this region. If we can get the politicians, and they do back us, and we can give them the information for them to go to London and tell the politicians and tell the government what we need and how great we are, and they do that. I think that we have to have faith in them and trust them that that's what they'll do for us.
And is there touching on what you the way you started describing around HS2 and things. So is the plan to take passengers off the main route between Euston and Birmingham and make that more freight and then move passengers onto HS2, or is it both actually?
It's creating more infrastructure. Okay. So adding more lines, being able to put the passenger, I haven't got the finite amount of detail, but it's basically increasing the amount of capacity that can run between London and Birmingham, because rail reform is all about creating more capacity. One of the things that's happening on the East Coast, if you're ever going into London and you look just past Peterborough, East Coast Digital Signalling Project is undergoing at the minute, which is a massive project, very, very expensive. But what that will do is it will create more capacity by having the signalling in such a way that more trains can be on the track at any one time, but safely. Our signalling system is quite old-fashioned. It's one train in any one section. It's a bit complicated, but it's quite restrictive in the number of trains that can be on the track at any one time. Right. But by bringing in the new digital signalling system, we will be able to have more trains to actually run, and that will open up the opportunity for more freight to come in as well at night. So it's all about greater capacity, getting cars and lorries off the road and increasing the amount of trains available for both people and freight to use.
Why do you think, without getting political, why do you think we haven't had the, I guess, investment in infrastructure that other countries have had? I've been to Japan and China, and the rail infrastructure there is just incredible. And then I come here and I go on the Northern Line and I'm freezing and it's rattling, and I'm thinking, where have we gone wrong?
Oh, I think if I knew the answer to that, I'd probably be a millionaire, or I might be the Prime Minister, which I don't want to be. I've worked in Australia, Dubai, you know, I've seen what the art of the possible is. It's a really good question, and I haven't got an answer for that. I think the only thing I would say is that, you know, by looking at what businesses like Hull Trains have delivered, that's the exemplar for me. That's what great would look like. And, you know, if you look at the performance and the number of trains that Hull Trains now cancel since it got its new rolling stock, it's very few. And most of the time it's as a result of overhead lines coming down, which is obviously not their fault. I think it's important that we stick by the transport industry and we see what you can do. Looking at countries like Japan, it costs an awful lot of money, but I do think that it's well worth it. You know, if you look at the Middle East, they watch what we do. So if you know, when I went out to Sydney or to Dubai, if they know you work for Transport for London, for example, they want to take your brain and download everything you know, because they want to mirror everything we do. So we're doing something right. We're a bit behind the times in terms of the amount of investment you'd need to become a Japan or a Dubai. But the principles of transport delivery is what we've set out and led the world on. So I wouldn't underestimate how good we are at transport. It's just we don't have the shiny new trains and the shiny infrastructure that these countries haven't got and have the money to invest in.
I think you're right on Hull Trains. I was reading an article actually about kind of government policy, and they were talking about open access as being the future.
Yes.
And they were talking about Hull Trains as being the exemplar within open access as well.
Yes.
So, brilliant achievement. Sorry, you're going
to
say something?
Yeah, I was going to take it back to your buses. When you're at TfL, obviously you've got the red, you know, the red bus, or whatever, what would it be called? What was, anyway, the normal buses are all red, aren't they? But then didn't you introduce another service?
Yes. Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. So, Sadiq Khan is a very ambitious mayor, and one of the things people don't always recognise in bus is that it's a link to other modes of transport in London. So if you live in London, you've got the chance to travel by Elizabeth Line, the DLR, overground, underground, cycle hire and bus. But outer London doesn't have that sort of opportunity. So what the mayor wanted was for people living in outer London who didn't want to get penalised by ULEZ and the congestion charge by having links into all the other modes of transport. So we invented, if you want to call it that, Superloop, which basically is almost a 360-degree outer London bus service, which has got really great buses, it's got faster bus journey times, and they then link into the DLR, the Elizabeth Line, the underground. So if you live out in outer London, you've got those links. And London is all about connectivity. Mm. It's all about, you know, if you want to get from one side of London to the other, and you've ever been in London, you know, you jump off one tube, you jump onto the Elizabeth Line, you'll then go. And that, the Superloop almost brings it all together. It also links the airports as well. So if you want to get to Heathrow Airport, and you could get one of the Superloop services, they're branded differently. They will eventually all be state of the art. So they'll all have USB chargers. They'll have holders for the mobile phones. They'll have extra areas for luggage, nice coffee shop flooring, LED lighting. So they are going to, and if you see them, you can't miss them. They look different to the red buses. But one of the things we wanted to do while I was director of buses was to create a differentiation in terms of the offer. So you've got your Superloop, you've got the buses which will service within local estates, and then you've got your box standard red bus, which you'll see in central London. So really, London is all about innovation, and they lead the way on that in terms of transport. So making buses much more exciting, sexy for people, because a lot of people, the last time they went on a bus might have been a swimming lesson when they were 11, and their memories are rattly windows, steamed up windows, horrible seats. But to make sure that we can absolutely reduce the number of cars on the road, the bus is a fantastic opportunity to do that. So, you know, if you go on Route 63 in London, for example, you'll see, again, state-of-the-art buses with glass sunroofs, USB chargers, bell pushes on every seat, absolutely superb, leather seats, leather headrests. And it's really to attract people who would not normally think about using a bus, to actually think, actually, this is okay. I can sit on the top deck. I can look out and see things in London I wouldn't normally see and get to where I want to get to. So it's leading the way into globally in terms of what the bus offering is, and Superloop is part of that.
Mm, I like that. So the podcast is called Tomorrow's Workplace Today. So we try and kind of cast your mind forward 5-10 years.
Yes.
So from the perspective of public transport, how do you think that's going to change? What are the big macro factors that are going to change over the next 10 years in that world?
I think we're on the cusp of something massive in terms of not so much heavy rail, but light rail and bus, in terms of decarbonisation and sustainability. So it's all about reducing the number of cars on the road and really investing in things like tram systems, light rail systems, bus, if you go to somewhere like Sydney, for example, I was part of the Sydney Light Rail development. If you've ever been there, a place called George Street runs down the centre of Sydney. You know, you can see what's coming. You know, cars are never going to be welcome in cities in the future, major cities, and even not such big cities. It's all about creating a multimodal, connected public transport offering so that people don't need to think about having a car. What's quite interesting is when I go and speak in schools, certainly in London, when I was 17, the first thing I wanted to do was get a car, pass my driving test, and off I go. If you go to London and you talk to the young people in colleges there, they don't even think about a car. Only 25% of people in London have cars. And I think that's the future. And young people have a massive moral compass. They don't want to do the damage we've done to the air quality. They want safe streets. They want really clean air. And they want to be the reason why they have clean air for their children. So I think we're on the cusp of something massive in terms of innovation around design of the public transport offering, thinking about the customer all the time, and offering something that would make you or I leave our cars in the drive and not even think of driving to where we want to go because there's a really great connected public transport system.
And what about for Hull then? Is that the same for Hull? How do you see Hull's infrastructure changing and a Hull City Council tapping into your knowledge and expertise?
So,
well, that's a loaded question.
Well, no, genuine question, are they?
Not at the minute, no.
They need to watch the podcast and they will.
But I do think that, you know, we've got the opportunity to have great bus services, for example, that can really work and support the nighttime economy. So if you are, you know, when my daughters go out in the evening and they go down Humber Street, for example, they want to go out for a night out and obviously have drummed into the new Dirt Drink and Drive. Mm. They then have to queue for hours on a cold winter's night waiting for a taxi. If we had a night bus service like London has, can you imagine the nighttime economy? You see all the clubs and pubs and restaurants that are shutting now for whatever reason in the city centre. If we had a great public transport system that really tapped into that and had a great night bus service, I think that would see a huge growth in the nighttime economy in Hull. And I think there is a direct correlation between public transport and economic growth. And yes, we're not London. I accept we're not London and I accept we haven't got the money. But there are things we can do which would really encourage people to leave their cars at home. But we need the transport offering to do that. And we need a public transport strategy. And I'm sure Hull City Council and East Riding Council have got one somewhere. But, you know, sitting down and thinking about that bigger picture and what the next 10 years would look like. And, you know, if I'm sat here in 10 years' time, what would that look like and how it would benefit shops, bars, pubs, education, you know, attracting people to want to come to Hull University, for example. There's so much you can do, but it just needs a bit of thought, well, a lot of thought, and a lot of people offering their opinions, if you like.
That's what frustrates me a bit about, obviously, I'm from the South, so used to get on the night bus quite a lot, thought it was brilliant. But that's what frustrates me about, you know, politicians or, you know, councils and things like that, when you've got knowledge and expertise like Louise and no one wants to tap into it and at least get some ideas and then maybe engage in something and say, well, actually, can you help? It's on your doorstep. It's frustrating.
What I think is really interesting is now we've got remote working. And if you look at how much houses cost in London, you know, I know that from the flat I had in London. You know, what could somebody in London, if they sold their house in London and came to live in the East Riding of Yorkshire and they could work remotely and then get Hull trains, for example, up to London once a week? I regularly go to Hull to London for the day. I went twice last week, actually. They could come and live here. And the children could be educated here. They could go to the great universities we've got. You know, they could work for some of the big businesses we've got here. But there's such opportunity here for people to come and relocate. But we need other things to attract them. So it's great that we've got now that link between, we've kept the link between Hull and London on the East Coast Main Line. But why don't we invest in thinking about, you know, public transport here? to really make it look appealing for people to want to relocate, and the money that they'd bring to the area, what they could offer in terms of their experiences and their knowledge could be huge. And I think the opportunity to work remotely is brings with it huge opportunities for cities like Hull. You know, you look at beautiful cities like towns like Beverley and Cottingham and Swanland and Willoughby, and you go further out to Howden, and you know, these are great places and places I'm really proud to say I'm from. And when I used to work in London, people used to laugh at my accent. I used to show them photographs of the Marina and Beverley Minster and places like that, and they'd say, "Where's that?" And I'd say, "Well, that's where I'm from." And they're like, "What?" Because they'd never think to come. But we've got so much to offer, and we could make this a place where people really want to relocate.
Completely agree.
I think we'll leave it there. But it's been brilliant. Amazing to get your expertise, and fantastic to get such an advocate for Hull and East Riding as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for asking me.